On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
I want to pose an exquisite dilemma for my co-host on today's Conversation Hour. We're going to be looking at a couple of delicate issues, including housing affordability. That's coming up shortly. But my co-host is ABC News presenter, broadcaster, former vice president of the Melbourne Football Club, Beverly O'Connor. And for people with long memories, she is no stranger to a microphone on this radio station. Hi, Bev.
It is delicious to be here. Delicious to be here.
Oh.
I thought I would start with one of your best.
That's a dad joke.
I know. Are you delighted to see me?
Oh, you've got a whole list. I'm sure you're going to be working through them. Hey, I've got an exquisite dilemma for you. What would you do? This is what happened to me yesterday. I told this story briefly on the radio this morning when I was chatting to our breakfast team, but there's a lot of people who just joined us from regional radio who may not have heard and will appreciate this. What do you do? I'm at a memorial service for a recently deceased man in his 50s who is the brother of a very dear friend of ours, and we knew him reasonably well too. Mikey was a fanatical Collingwood supporter and a man who lived with very serious intellectual and physical disabilities all his life, very serious ones. He was childlike in his very uncomplicated view of the world. At his funeral, one of his sisters spoke, two of the nephews spoke, there were lots of stories told, and everyone was prepared for the, you know, a few tears and all of those sorts of things. The slideshow was showing. There were beautiful songs. And then we were all asked at the very end of the service, we were all asked to stand and join in with the family in singing the Collingwood theme song. So my exquisite dilemma,
your love of Collingwood.
Do I offend the family and stay mute or join in and sing the Collingwood theme song?
Not even a dilemma.
What would Bev O'Connor, former vice president of the Melbourne Football Club and sitting here in the studio in a Melbourne scarf, what would you do?
I would sing in celebration of him.
And his life.
And his life. And it's as simple as that. And I can't imagine why it's given you a moment's pause. Because it's not about you in that moment.
No, it's Collingwood.
It's about him. It doesn't matter.
It's Collingwood.
I think these are things that we have to in 2018. You know, I think
Any other club, not a problem.
Well, it's interesting because for me in 1990, I know, but you did tip them once this year and I came and admonished you for it. So let's not forget that moment in time.
Yes, yeah, because Eddie had been particularly nice to me that week.
Oh, sold his soul for a hug from Eddie. What a price. And you're in a dilemma at a situation like this. I mean, I thought to myself, what would it take? 30 pieces of silver? No, just a little embrace.
Yeah, that's all.
I acknowledge your presence, John Fain.
No, it was a bit more than that. We did a bit of bonding, so yeah, we shared a common problem. But hey, I thought it was lovely. It was very funny, and they were cacking themselves, the family, all the siblings
else
and
to
nieces
sing.
And nephews, yeah, saying, yeah, ha ha ha, now you've all got to sing. And everybody did, of course we did.
Don't you think, I thought in 1990 the city divided in the way they did for the Doggies, in the way they did for Richmond, and in a beautiful sense, yeah. I'm getting that feeling about Melbourne this year. Even though I don't want to talk about our prospects because it's really difficult.
Funny you mentioned 1990. Mikey lived in a group home with carers and all the rest of it. And as I say, he was very childlike in his approach to the world. Every night of his life, he would watch a DVD of the 1990 Collingwood Grand Final, and every night Collingwood would win.
And did people say to him, who won every morning?
Yeah. Oh, and his sister, who's our very dear friend Mars, who's like family for us, his sister would ring him every night and usually on FaceTime, and she'd say, how are you, Mikey, and is everything okay, and speak to the carers and all this sort of thing, make sure that she was his guardian and she would make sure he was okay. And every night, and we countless times we would participate in this, countless times, the conversation was, is Collingwood winning? Yes, Collingwood's winning.
How's the game going?
Yeah, exactly. Every single night of the week.
Mm. And there is the power of football right there for you. That is gorgeous. That is so beautiful. Yeah. So you sang?
And I sought the family's permission last night as we were sitting around eating pizzas. And
to tell the story.
Way too late at night for me, actually. And I said, do you mind if I talk about this tomorrow? And they went, we would love it. Mikey would love it. We would love it.
And we do.
Go for it.
Beautiful. And did you sing this? You did sing.
I did. I mumbled along.
Of course,
along.
You mumbled along because, like the national anthem, you don't know the words.
Well, they had them on the screen. They came up. They came up on the screen.
So you couldn't avoid it.
No, we gave him a good final send off, and that's exactly what we should do. Of
beautiful.
Course.
That's yes. fantastic.
So, Melbourne. There you are. You're not used to the middle of September still being an active participant in football, are you?
It's such a strange feeling. And, you know, to be fair, when I was on the board for
which was how many years ago?
So that was 2009 to 2008. So not, we were in the finals every other year.
Sorry, 2000 and
until 2008.
Right, okay.
So we were in the finals every other year. We got to a grand final in 2000. So I had that experience.
Did you? Who was that against?
Essendon in
really?
All their might.
Oh, okay.
So, and of course, Hawthorn in 88, where they were also a hugely dominant team, and Essendon. And that's my
88,
kind.
That's 30 years ago.
So what? When, oh, I can't talk to you, but you're the damn Brisbane Lions, who were my favourite second team.
Yeah, we did all right for a while there.
But this is different because it does feel like we've had this wilderness period, this period of no one caring and people feeling really disillusioned. And then there's this kind of real sense of building, but also what I haven't experienced and didn't experience in 2000 of the city getting on side, on our side.
Yeah, we
which is different.
Well, we love an underdog, don't we?
We love an underdog.
It's a national
and
characteristic.
We have epitomised the underdog.
Well, that's why
for
the Bulldogs were so much everybody's sentimental favourite.
Mine too.
A couple of years ago, and then Richmond were last year. Everyone went, well, maybe they can dream.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing.
And now we're saying, well, mind you, I pity whichever club comes up against Richmond in the grand final on the assumption that it will be Richmond.
Precisely. And that is my fear of having we have another grand final appearance where you come up against this dominant force who is on a bit of a special run, and they are a special team. I was super excited to try and see any glimpse of problems with
Dusty.
Dusty's knee on television. But it was just misleading. But look, we are already winners. I feel the progress, the sense of the guys, the way they play together, the sense of, you know, I've spoken to Lee Matthews about this over the years, that Brisbane group, trying to understand what gels a team, what brings them together, what makes them seize their destiny. And it's a very unique thing. And when you see a team starting to do that, you really feel that something really exciting could happen.
Hmm. What is it? Because when I watched your club the other night, and it was a great game.
It was.
It was a very entertaining game of football. And, you know, people say, oh, the thrill's gone out of the game and so on. But that's just not right. Both games last weekend
were brilliant.
Were fabulous to watch.
Brilliant.
They were great spectacles. And some of the high marking, I mean, that kid at Collingwood. So many of the Melbourne players wouldn't have a clue who they are. They're so young. They're so new. They haven't established themselves. They're not superstars.
They're no names.
They're just really solid. And that was really exciting.
It was exciting. But then we did have players like Jordan Lewis, who's a wise head, who's been around, has had that kind of experience that you saw him, and particularly in the match the previous week against Geelong. So there is that kind of mix, and you have a Gorn who is just a superstar. You keep seeing. What it was is that continual extra effort, that second and third effort, which you saw from the Brisbane Lions throughout that heyday that
and
they
Grundy
had.
And Grundy does it so well for Collingwood.
Absolutely.
So he'll ruck and then he'll rove his own ball,
they
and
never
he doesn't stop.
Yeah. They never stop. They
that
never
intensity.
Think that moment is over, and we were doing it in quarters this year, and now we're suddenly doing it for four. So, but to your point, what makes it? Lee Matthews always used to say, is it the coach? Is it what? And he said it's an inexplicable magic where it's the group that understands what they want.
So, how did the South African import ever get into Aussie rules anyway?
Hard to explain. I just fell in love with the game. So
how old
pure
were you when
and
you
simple.
Came over here?
22. And in fact, I lived in Sydney for a year, and the only thing that I noticed in Sydney was Jeffrey Edelston, his pink, because there was this rugby world going on, and this kind of thing caught my fancy. And
Jeffrey Edelston?
In terms of, you remember, it was that era. We had Warwick Capper in his pink shorts and Jeffrey
Edelston. It was Warwick Capper that got Bev O'Connor at 22.
No.
That's what.
No. It was Robbie Flower at 24.
I went to school with Robbie Flower.
Did you really?
Yeah.
He was the one that made me really fall in love with football. But
I was in social studies class with Robbie Flower, Melbourne High, 1970.
Was he a good student?
No.
Were you a good student?
Oh, it was a bit of a swap.
Average.
See, Melbourne High used to offer year 11 or 12, mostly 12, to kids who came with
for the football clubs. So they'd come into Melbourne to join football clubs, and Melbourne High would offer them a place in order to boost the club's football
size.
So my sixth form, we had Robbie Flower, Shane Fitzsimmons, Jenkinson from Richmond, Renee Kink and Bill Picken from Collingwood.
Wow.
All playing for Melbourne High in the same year.
That's not right. That is not right.
Yeah.
So, wow, that's incredible. Well, no, he was magic to watch.
He was.
There was something. And I grew up doing...
He was balletic.
And there is your answer. I grew up doing ballet.
Oh.
And for me, this was a game that I completely identified with. And I saw lots of those high-flying pack marks again this weekend, which just, that's what I fell in love with. That athleticism. So, yep, that was me done. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And here we are.
Well, here we are, but then you got more and more involved.
I did. And I was, you know, you're very blessed sometimes to just have... Somebody said to me once too, perhaps because I grew up in South Africa, I didn't have this kind of sense of a divide between men and women, what we could or couldn't do. For me, and potentially too, a lot of the people who introduced me to football were fellow colleagues who didn't have a sense of, you know, there was a woman who wouldn't do these kind of things or didn't have a right to talk about football. That was the other thing that struck me, the genderlessness, even in those days, of footy.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever excluded women from conversations.
No. A couple of text messages. John, get over it. The Pies are a fantastic club, do great things in the community. What did Collingwood ever do to you, John, says Grant and Glen Waverley. You need to get over what
it's
happened in the
dark
1920s and 30s. I'm not that old, Grant. Oh, dear. And I have more reason to hate your team, the Lions, for the years 2002 and 2003. And Paul in Wallen says, you're not fooling anyone with this blatant attempt to humanise yourself. We can see through you. Yeah, right. Okay, thank you. Bev O'Connor is my co-host. If you've got a long memory, you may remember Bev O'Connor doing a late evening program on the old 3LO.
Oh, 3LO. That's right. It was Australia Tonight.
Australia Tonight back in the early 90s.
Yes, indeed. We used
now,
to cross across the country. And breakfast on the station.
Breakfast as
remember,
well.
Remember, after...
Rod
Sue
McNeil.
Howard.
After Sue Howard, after Rod McNeil. Yeah, there you go.
The heady days of breakfast.
Bev O'Connor, former Vice President of the Melbourne Football Club, now presenter of The World on ABC News TV, on the news channel The World, and still in harness here at the ABC and thriving too. Bev O'Connor is my co-host, and our first guest is the Cranlana Program moderator and adjunct fellow at Swinburne University Centre for Urban Transitions, Peter Mayers. For many years, Peter was an ABC broadcaster at Radio National. Indeed, when I joined the ABC in 1989, Peter was one of the people I first met on my first day. He now is a full-time author and moderator and has written a book about Australia's housing crisis called No Place Like Home. Welcome back to an ABC studio, Peter.
John, lovely to be here. Thank you.
I've always said the ABC is all the poorer for the fact that people like you no longer work here, so I'll just put that back on the record.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Now, this
and
is
I
a,
do miss it. But
yeah,
ditto.
Well, we
yeah.
miss you too. This is a
Thanks,
scholarly and heavily footnoted account of Australia's housing crisis.
But don't say that, John, because people might think
also
it's good.
It's also a personal journey. So you've straddled the personal and the analytical, which is not an easy thing to do. Why did you approach the topic in the first
place? Well, I approached it in that way. Let's put it this way. Because there's lots of reporting on Australia's housing crisis or housing issues. And you might find, on the one hand, you have a story about auction clearance rates and how great it is, the record prices at one part of the paper, and in the same paper, in a different section of the newspaper, you'll have a story about homelessness or a story about how people can't afford to buy a house, and as if these two things weren't connected. And you get these episodic kind of surges of coverage, of story here, story there. And then you've got a whole lot of heavily researched, detailed information through groups like AHURI, the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, or Industry Reports, Grattan Institute, that's quite dense and full of data and that sort of thing. And my idea was to try and access that analytical work and that research and that data and combine it with traditional journalistic techniques, storytelling, first-person observation, narrative, and so on, to try and unpack it all, make it accessible to people. And You know, I begin with a story about walking around the centre of Melbourne, talking to a homeless guy, and watching all these cranes on the skyline and saying, what's going on here?
How does the one fit the other? You won't like me distilling a 300-page book down to one sentence that you've written here, but you say we need a wholesale shift away from the exalted idea of home ownership, and we have to stop thinking of homes as an asset and still instead think of them as something that the community gets benefit from. That's a pretty tall order, a big ask, isn't it?
It is a big ask. I mean, I guess if we talk about a housing crisis, and I use the word crisis in the title, I say repairing Australia's housing crisis, so all the answers are in there, John. But really, if we think about crisis, what do we mean? We mean the bottom 20%. We mean the 116,000 people without a roof over their heads, without secure housing. We mean the 600,000 families on low incomes or households on low incomes who are in rental stress. That means they're spending 30% or more of their disposable income on their rent, which means they don't have enough to put the heating on in winter sometimes, or they don't have enough to feed themselves properly and that sort of thing. So that's the crisis I'm really interested in, and that's where I think we need to go.
But the culture shift, it's not about to happen, is it? The culture shift is my point.
No, and I think that comes to your very point as to where you started your book, Peter, because I don't think the connect of the housing crisis has anything to do with the homeless, which is where you start your story, with that juxtaposition of a homeless person that you encounter all the time. I don't think we, most Australians, see homelessness as a crisis, as part of the housing crisis, nor the fact that there are so many people very close to that very
People at risk of ending up in homelessness.
So
it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've had 28 years of uninterrupted economic growth, and we're a much richer society than we were in the past, and yet we have rising levels of housing stress and rising levels of homelessness. So these two things don't fit together very comfortably for me. I would have thought that as a society that has an idea of a fair go and that sort of thing, that we would want to do better than this. Now, we could say, well, it's maybe all those people who are in housing stress or homeless, maybe it's their fault. Maybe it's all those individuals' fault. But I don't think that stacks up. It's got to be more something around the way we do things. And, John, to come back to your point about shifting away from the Great Australian Dream, we're shifting away from the Great Australian Dream by default. You know, home ownership rates are dropping, and they're dropping fastest amongst younger age groups, and they're dropping fastest amongst lower income households, and they're dropping fastest in big cities like Sydney and Melbourne, where the price increases in housing have been the greatest.
But people still dream about it.
Yeah, people do still dream about it. But what's more important than everyone owning their own home is everyone having a secure home, and they're not the same thing.
They're certainly not. Now, you also talk about tax policy, which it's the elephant in the corner of the room.
Yep.
And we start to get into political hot potatoes here, because one of our major political parties, the Labor Party, have said they'll have a look at things like negative gearing, which is kind of
The last election they made a concrete set of policy proposals. Yep. They said they would restrict negative gearing.
And they're still committed to those things.
As far as I know, they are.
And the other party says, no, we won't. So you're immediately getting into kind of, hang on, you're backing in one horse here, are you not?
Am I?
Yep.
Oh, well, I think the Labor Party's policies are better than the Coalition's policies on those things, if you're asking for my opinion on it. I think that reforming negative gearing... So the idea behind negative gearing, obviously, if people hear the term all the time, maybe don't know what it means, but say I'm paying interest on an investment property, the rent doesn't cover the interest, then the gap between the interest and the rent, I can claim that against my other income.
If you make a loss.
If I make a loss,
on your little business venture of an individual property.
That's right. So I'm getting a tax benefit. Now, the people who benefit from that are generally high-income earners and wealthy, the wealthier sections of society. And if my chair just disappeared on me. If we could say that resulted in cheaper rent or more affordable rental accommodation, I'd say, well, that's maybe a worthwhile trade-off. But it doesn't. It just means that investors bid up housing prices in competition with first home buyers and others.
Although the cautionary warning issued is that if you change the rules on negative gearing, investors will abandon rental properties.
Yes, but,
and then that'll lead to a shortage and push rents up.
I don't want to be defending Labor's policy here, but Labor has said in their proposals they would grandfather existing arrangements, so there's no reason for people who have already invested to abandon, and they would continue negative gearing for people buying new properties. So therefore, the tax incentive, and it's a very... you know, it's a big subsidy that the government offers by providing this tax break. The tax benefit goes to the creation of new housing, which increases supply, which deals with our housing, helps deal with our housing affordability issues. So that's why it seems to be to me to make sense. And the other side of it is the capital gains tax discount. And we can talk about that if you want, with the risk of people's eyes glazing over.
No, but I think it is all, for me, the greater issue of this divide has become, when I think back to when we were all much younger, the three of us in the room, covering state rounds, covering issues like public housing. It seems to me that this whole debate, at the moment, there is no political will for it. There is no political will in terms of long-term vision. There's even the public housing that now is up for grabs for redevelopment. It's all about kind of how people should stand on their own two feet. It's kind of moved away from that expectation that we would, as a society, provide for people who did not have or could not find housing. So there's two things. There's lack of political will, and also this divide between those who now have this, who've accumulated the properties, who've accumulated the wealth, and don't want to let that go.
Yeah. So if we think, my wife and I bought our first house in 1990, and we paid $137,500 for a house in Northcote, 6 kilometres from the CBD. A double-fronted weatherboard Californian bungalow. That house, according to property websites, is now worth about $1.8 million. Now, some of that may be because my wife and I renovated it and planted nice things in the garden. Most of it is purely due to the increase in the underlying value of the land. So that is a windfall gain. To people who, like
you
us...
You don't need any more help from the tax office.
No, people who entered the property market at a time when, on a relatively modest salary, you could afford to buy a house, have benefited. And 60% of homeowners bought their homes before 2011. And amongst those who bought more recently, they may have been trading up anyway. So a lot of people have benefited, have a lot of housing wealth. Now, I think it's reasonable to ask to say, let's share some of that wealth. I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to ask.
So the last Prime Minister I had the chance to put this to was Malcolm Turnbull in the last election campaign, and he was here sitting in the very chair you're sitting in, speaking into the very microphone you're speaking into, and I put to him, this was a matter of intergenerational theft. And my question was, if we go to an auction this weekend, Mr. Turnbull, you and I would be competing and bidding against our own kids' generation, and we'll always win because we have the advantage of negative gearing, so we have deeper pockets.
And we have assets to borrow against.
The only way you can negatively gear is if you've already got an existing property, you borrow against it in order to buy the next one, create an artificial loss because you borrow so much that you ensure the rent doesn't cover the mortgage, and that way you generate a loss that you reduce your tax with. Let's not pretend it's done for any other reason. And you acquire assets on the taxpayer's subsidy. You're building up an asset portfolio with subsidies from the taxpayer. And I said, but it's unfair just at the auction level. And he said, what, are your kids struggling? This was Malcolm Turnbull's response. Are your kids struggling to get into the housing market? And I said, yes, they are. And he said, well, a man of your wealth, you should be buying your kids a house. And thankfully, I thought quickly enough to say, but that's hardly a housing policy, Prime Minister. I also said, yeah, that's what my kids say to us, but still. But that's hardly a housing policy, but that's where we're at. The bank of mum and dad is the only way kids can get into the market.
The parental bank is what happens. And what's that doing? That is entrenching intergenerational inequality. So my son will be fine because he'll inherit whatever housing wealth my wife and I have left when we kick the bucket, and he won't pay any tax on that. And as I've indicated to you, the sorts of numbers we're talking about, the sorts of, you know, gain that has been made.
It doesn't allow him, though, to necessarily live in the dignity he wants throughout his... He's waiting. It's not a policy.
He's rubbing his hands. But we can afford to support him in the meantime. So, you know, it's not like... we also have the assets to support him.
But not every parent does either.
No, that's right. People in rental accommodation certainly don't. So, we are building inequality into bricks and mortar, and we should be deeply concerned about it. Let me give you one statistic. Okay, well, I'll try not to put too many statistics out there. But in 2004, the top fifth of wealthy Australians, so the wealthiest fifth of Australians, owned 1.3 times as much property as everyone else combined, the other four-fifths. And we've had 12 years of real estate boom, And the top fifth now own 1.5 times as much property as the bottom four, as everyone else combined. So the system is enriching the rich. But it's making the wealthier wealthier.
The Productivity Commission recently said inequality is shrinking.
No, they didn't. If you read the report more in a more careful manner, they said it's far more complex picture than that. And it depends on whether you're talking about income inequality or wealth inequality. They're two, you know, you have to look at both those things. Certainly Australia has a fairly good tax and transfer system. We do a better job than a lot of countries in redistributing wealth. Or redistributing income, but we don't do it with property.
You're assuming that redistributing wealth is in fact a worthwhile goal. There are a lot of people who would not agree. There are a lot of people who say, well, look, you know, it's a tough old world out there. It's dog eat dog, sharpen your elbows, get out there and see what you can grab.
Well, get used to stepping over people in Bourke Street Mall, John, when they sleep in doorways. I mean, if that's just the sort of society we want, then fine. My argument is if we, you know, the market has never provided housing for people at the bottom. That is a role for government. It doesn't mean that people shouldn't make their own efforts. The benefits of home ownership are such that people will work for that, as they do. But if we want to live in a society that is decent and fair, then we need to provide measures that counteract the tendency of the market to cater for those who already have. And we need to think about those people at the bottom end. And as we did in the post-war period, build affordable housing for people on low incomes.
Can I just get your thoughts too, and you write about this obviously in the book as well, about the effect of foreign buyers, migration and density.
Okay. Some of the startling figures, I mean, you went and investigated the empty apartment buildings where no water is consumed in the vast majority of the apartments in an entire block. What did you find?
Well, it's... So there are a lot of empty apartments, and some of them are empty because they're between being sold or whatever. But there do seem to be a lot of people who are able to hold on to an apartment. They use a few days a year on an occasional visit, or they may just be waiting for it to go up in value. Good luck to them, because it's not going to do that now, I don't think. But I don't think empty apartments are the main problem. I think underutilization of housing is a bigger problem. So there are a lot of people with two and three spare bedrooms, people in houses much bigger than they need. And again, the tax system encourages us to overinvest in housing, and that makes us a highly indebted country. You know, we have one of the highest levels of household debt in the world, and that is because we borrow so heavily to buy housing, and we buy more housing than we need.
So it's not just the tax system. You also spent a bit of time with the woman who has now become our Lord Mayor,
yes,
Sally Capp, who had a personal tale to tell, one that I was completely unaware of, which you report on in detail. What happened?
Yeah, she talked about it at an event with the Grattan Institute, so I went and talked to her more about it. This is when she was head of the Property Council of Victoria. So
She became the mayor.
She became Lord Mayor, and that's when I interviewed her before. And so she had a property in Boroondara on a major road.
A residence. Her family lived in this property.
But it had a big garden, and she thought, we could redevelop this, we could build some townhouses, we could build some apartments. And that fitted, as far as she understood it, within the residential code, because it wasn't, you know, a leafy back street, it was a busy road. And this would create a lot more housing, and that's good. We need more housing. There's no doubt that increasing the supply of housing is an important part of the issue here.
So it's a big block of land on Glenferrie Road, owned by, and a family home.
Yep.
Owned by the head of the Property Council.
And she was planning a mix. She was planning a mix of property, not just for elite.
So there was a mix of apartments, some townhouses.
Yeah. Knock it down and develop. Yep. What happened?
Well, what happened was her neighbours objected. Neighbours in the streets behind objected. And long and short of it is, she gave up. She sold off some of the land to neighbours behind her, and she did a much smaller development. And so we lost an opportunity to increase the housing supply. Now,
well, we still did increase the housing supply, but not to the same extent.
Not to the degree.
This is on Glenferrie Road, where there were apartment buildings all around already. Yeah.
Absolutely. She was motivated from her time in London, and as her critics would point out, to make money, and that's part of it.
Yeah.
But she was also motivated when she found how her family lived in London in an apartment quite comfortably, quite happily.
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, we can learn to do that too, to your point about how much housing do we really need.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of housing we need is not so much the big towers we're seeing in the inner city, some of which have, I think, are very badly designed, very poorly built,
very temporary,
but more medium density, medium rise housing in areas where they, you know, where there is good transport links, where there's access to jobs and employment, access to services, schools, childcare, and so on. So you asked me before, Beverly, about three issues. I think one was
immigration.
Well. One was foreign investment. So let's deal with foreign investment. That's kind of the easy one in a way. Foreign investors can only buy new housing. So if a foreign investor buys a house in Australia, then that means they're increasing the housing supply. I don't think foreign investors are having a major impact on the house prices, but what do foreign investors buy? A lot of what we've seen built in the centre of Melbourne has been built for foreign investors.
And students. Temporary
student accommodation. There's a lot of that too. But if you're building a particular product that is an investment product rather than providing housing for locals, we may be ending up with not the kind of housing we really want or need for people in Melbourne. So there is an issue there, but I don't think it's an issue about price so much as the type of development we end up getting.
All royalties from the sale of this book are being donated to Melbourne City Mission's Front Yard program, and the book explains to you why. Peter spent a bit of time there. Peter Mayer's book is called No Place Like Home, Repairing Australia's Housing Crisis. Peter Mayer's, who now works with Swinburne University at the Centre for Urban Transitions and the Cranlana program run by the Meyer Foundation, former ABC foreign correspondent and also former Radio National presenter. And No Place Like Home can be found in all good bookshops and even some of the bad ones. And we're joined now by Pauline and Marcus. Pauline Neal is Coordinator of Youth Development at the Macedon Ranges Shire Council and co-founder of an organisation called Live for Life. Marcus Ward is a support after suicide peer support worker with the same regional area up in the same Macedon Ranges area. Marcus and Pauline, good morning to you both.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
How did this organisation get started?
Well, about 10 years ago, 2008 grand final weekend, John, Macedon Rangers lost two beautiful young men to suicide. And the Thursday before that weekend, a 15-year-old boy made a very serious attempt on his life. And they're the founding stories of Live for Life. So something had to shift for us, and we were able to be in a position with the council there to rejig what we did. And from that, we sat with schools and community and tried to work out if we could actually change a conversation with our young people around mental health and areas of distress. So we did that. And I think it'd be really important probably to throw to Marcus at the moment and understand the founding story, because suicide Sure. prevention work isn't just a good idea. It is generally born from need. And I just want to acknowledge people, you know, even here at the ABC and your listeners who are bereaved by suicide.
Oh, touches and, so many people. So, Marcus, tell us about your son.
So, John, Liam was 20 years of age when he took his life.
10 years ago
next week. And what I invariably do when I'm talking about Liam's loss is that I look at it from a perspective of why didn't we see this coming? As a parent, as a father, you wonder why you didn't see this event. You know your child well, you're close to them, etc. So the sorts of flags that we should have been seeing were remoteness from his family and friends, that he was not responsive to his family, that he was withdrawing, that there was mental health issues, or that there was alcohol or drug abuse. Those sorts of red flags should have been seen. The problem was for us that none of those red flags flew with our son. So we had no inkling whatsoever that our son was in the place that he was.
Do you think 10 years on, do you think you'd be better at seeing the signs?
I don't believe so, John. The communication, what I understand now in relation to suicide prevention is the need for communication. So having these tough conversations about events, for example, within my extended family, there was a nephew that attempted suicide and pleasingly is alive with us and well and happy and healthy. We never had the conversation at home about that event. So but we didn't need to.
How much earlier than your son's death had that occurred?
Two years, 18 months.
Right.
So, it was a conversation we didn't need to have. We had a son who was doing biomedical sciences at Melbourne University, had just been offered his dream year of honours the following year. playing basketball with a local team, was organising with his closest friend for a trip around the world the following year. So he had lots of reasons to be happy, healthy and enjoying himself, which he was, and we thought he was. And, of course, until we got the phone call to say that we needed to come home. So we were away for the weekend and I had to make that torturous drive back home to discover the loss of our son.
When you say, Marcus, that you look back and you don't think you could have done anything differently, have you learnt? Because you're talking about an open communication, a young man that seemed to have a lot happening in his life, a lot of positivity. Have you been able to learn anything from what might have been going on in his mind?
I wouldn't know where to look, Bev. As a parent, I wouldn't know where to look. This is where Live for Life is so important. I wish my son had gone through that process of Live for Life, that conversations that they have at schools. Maybe because it's not just the students that have that that conversation, it's also the parents. So it's wider. So there's that opportunity to be looking for the types of things that may be those red flags. I know that since I've done some training with mental health
first aid
and safe talk, there are things and elements and bait, I suppose, that's put out there, usually by a person who's struggling. I know that within my capacity, within what I do socially as a within my golf club, I've been approached by several guys in relation to their mental health struggles and their issues. So I'm far more aware now because of those training sessions, but I just wish that maybe my son had gone through a Live for Life, that maybe there was an opportunity for us to share conversation around it.
So what does the training, the Live for Life program involve? It works in schools? Is that how it works?
It's not just in schools, Peter. It's mental health education geared to Year 8s and essentially, and now more recently Year 11 students. And Year 8 was chosen because the mental health literacy we knew from evidence around the world, if we could inject that to 14-year-olds, we could increase their protective factors. You know, having the words to describe the feelings that they have.
So because the highest risk factors are going to come in the next few years?
Adolescence is tricky terrain, yep. And parenting is not for the faint-hearted. So I think that what we knew then was that if we put something in at the Year 8 level, because the evidence told us that the literacy was really important, two, it's easier to elbow into curriculum at Year 8. And three, for anyone that's had the joy of parenting a Year 9 student, it was pre-feral year. So it was a good mix. But
sure.
At the same time, it was about also educating teachers and parents. So it's not just about education in schools, it's the broader community.
Sure, it's the ripple effect. But Pauline, do you think it's worse now? Do you think this generation are more vulnerable? And if so, for what reason?
Well, look, it's a personal opinion. I don't have any evidence on it. But
I think
I've worked with young people for nearly 30 years, John, and I think the terrain in which they stand and navigate is very different to the terrain you and I navigated.
There's something going on. I mean, there are so many kids now who are upfront about the fact they've got problems. It's not just that they're more upfront about it. There just are more kids with problems. And I don't know why. It might be, is it social media? Is it the ubiquity of the handheld phone and the fact that everything now is compressed and short attention spans and all this sort of superficiality of supposedly having so-called friends on social media, but in fact they're just meaningless connections? What is it?
Is it fear of the future too, John? I mean, my son, I have a 20-year-old son, he says, you know, he's very depressed. Well, use that word, I shouldn't use that word depressed, but he's very concerned about what the future holds for him. He looks at climate change, he looks at Donald Trump, he looks at, you know, all sorts of doom and gloom, and he's worried.
And I think this is what I've experienced from a lot of my friends who have young men particularly, and I'd like to explore that topic, that we assume that this generation, because they've grown up with technology, with this ability, with this idea that things are going to constantly change for them, that they're okay with it.
Or are we just a bunch of middle-aged farts sitting around
okay
a radio studio?
Men, why are boys, do you think, because the statistics would seem to indicate that boys are the more vulnerable ones and those are where things are very high. Is that a communication issue in your mind? Is it that something that boys aren't taught to talk about their feelings?
Well, a couple of things on that, Beverly. I think You know, and I have three sons who are in their 20s, and like I said, parenting isn't for the faint-hearted, and because I do what I do, it doesn't mean that they're immune from mental health issues. Look, I think with boys, you know, we have to change the culture around that, and I think there's a lot of work and conversation around that currently. Just going back that, you know, whilst our rates around mental ill health and particularly around suicide reflect that men are 75% of those numbers of suicide, you know, we sit with a position where suicide generally is a position that people take to end levels of distress and despair and hopelessness, not so much about dying. People who have survived those attempts are able to tell us that, and that's why we hold that position. Women are three times more likely to make an attempt on their life. So we're not through the woods either. So I think that the conversation that we have in schools and in community is around speaking with all young people, regardless of vulnerability or regardless of whether or not they're the kids that people will say they're the ones at risk. All young people. And you hear Marcus's story about Liam. You know, his network, his friends, the kids he went to the uni with, his family, did not see any signs that Liam was struggling. And sometimes people will you know, hide that, will work very hard
very
at,
well.
At suppressing
it. I think the other element too is that we, because of the nature of what we hear in relation to bullying through social media, we tend to think it's a young person's thing. It's not. It's not just young men. It's you know, within the sphere of where I'm supporting in support after suicide. There are all ages. It's not located in one particular age group. As Pauline said, it's predominantly males, but it stretches right across the spectrum. Mm. I think the tradies are four times more likely to take their lives than the rest of the community. So people like Jeremy Holt, Jeremy Forbes from Holt, is working tirelessly in and around the state and interstate as well.
So that raises the city-country divide, yeah. And there's particular little almost clusters in particular areas. So how much more difficult is it for people in regional and rural and remote Australia than it is for people in the big capital cities?
I think it's clearly more difficult. Even if we take the issue of providing direct professional support on the ground in rural Victoria, that's challenging.
And Victoria is a very compact, the most compact mainland state, so... In Victoria, you're within reach of services, but in Queensland or West Australia, forget it.
You think about, you know, a 15 or 16-year-old kid living out in the eastern stretch of Macedon Ranges in Lancefield, how do they get to direct support? You know, if they don't have family support, I mean, they just can't hop on a train or a bus and get to somewhere. We don't have a headspace in there. I'm not advocating for a headspace either, but I think what we have to do is understand that the support for people on the ground in rural Victoria is very, very limited. So what Live for Life is trying to do is build the community's capacity to better support and understand young people. So we take youth mental health first aid training out to the CFA, men's sheds, you know.
Car clubs, huge networks.
Yep, huge. We had 15 dads at the pub. Four Tuesday nights in a row, 6 till 10.
Dads at the pub?
Dads at the pub. Go figure.
That was hard to fill.
But they turn up. You know, they do a full day at work. They commute from the city, 6 till 10.
I go to swap meets for old cars and motorbikes and I say, why isn't there an outreach tent? And no one's going to walk up in the middle of a swap meet and go in there and say, I want some counselling, but at least it means people are aware what's available. They might just pick up a brochure or at least recognise a name. And you've got to be visible. You've got to be out there.
There's got to be triggers for you. Triggers of support rather than triggers of other thoughts.
So if we can educate community to pick up some really early signs and know what to do about that, we stand a much better chance of having a really healthy, vibrant community. So Live for Life is really about getting into rural communities and arming them with the information they need. Youth Live for Life is the organisation that's doing that. The funds that we're raising at the moment are to go to that organisation to build their capacity to actually muck in with communities. We don't just send them a book on how to do it. Mm. We actually physically go and sit in those communities and help them navigate that terrain. We're out in Glenelgshire, down at Portland, and up in Benalla as well.
Marcus Ward, best wishes and thank you for being so honest with everybody. It's commendable.
Appreciate the opportunity.
And Pauline Neal from the Macedon Ranges Shire Council, Live for Life. Bev O'Connor's been my co-host. Peter Mayer's book once more called No Place Like Home. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.